You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In many states, parents with a child in jail are made to pay up to $1,000 a month for their child's incarceration. More often than not, these costs are crippling to poor families that are already dealing with the emotional trauma associated with their child's crime and detention. And although this has been happening for over 40 years, things may be starting to change. Eli Hager, a staff reporter for the Marshall Project, writes about it in his investigative piece, Your Kid Goes to Jail, You Get the Bill. It was published by the Marshall Project and the Washington Post, and I'm very pleased it has brought Eli Hager to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your beat is the criminal justice system. When did you start hearing about this?
Well, I had actually been reporting on intersections between the child support system and the criminal justice system. And I had heard from several parents in several states that they were being sent a nightly bill for their kids' incarceration. And I just wanted to know more.
Is this state policy or does it occur on the county level?
It depends. We found that in 19 states, the state-level juvenile justice system is the agency that bills the parents a nightly rate for their kids' detention. We found that in more than a dozen other states, they have decentralized systems, so it's mostly happening at the county level.
And how common, well, is it also in the tri-state area?
New York and New Jersey are actually two of the very few states that don't have a statute allowing this practice, but it happens in a significant way in Pennsylvania, which would be the closest state to us.
Can you explain why parents are required to pay for the jail time of their children?
Well, this arose out of an ideology several decades ago. Juvenile justice officials believed that parents were intentionally dumping their kids on the juvenile justice system. If their kids were delinquent or disruptive, parents were saying, we can't deal with these kids. And so in a number of states, they put this into the statute in order to be able to say, sure, we'll take the kids into detention, but you'll have to pay the costs. And the idea was that then the parents would become more engaged with their kids and trying to prevent the wrongdoing.
Isn't another justification that some cite that this is a form of child support?
Yes, that is now kind of the logic in a number of states. We found that in a dozen states, they actually use the child support system to send these bills out. So it's a form of child support. For 18 years, you're responsible for your kids wherever they're housed, even if it's in a jail.
Where does the money go?
The money goes, in most states, to the juvenile justice agency to support the costs of the juvenile detention. But in some other states, it just goes to a general fund.
And are there any exceptions ever made?
Yes, they in most states do have an ability to pay process. So the very poorest parents or parents who aren't working have very low bills. So, for example, we found that in Philadelphia, they were sending monthly bills of only $5 to some parents based on their ability to pay. So, but one shortcoming of that system is that it's just the parents negotiating with the juvenile justice agency often, and they may not have the paperwork or the wherewithal to be able to prove that they don't have the ability to pay.
Have these policies received popular support?
I don't think these policies are very well known, so I don't think that's a question that I can really answer. I think they've existed in many of these states for a long time, but I think a lot of people don't actually know that that's how it works.
Does it matter what the crime was?
No, it doesn't matter what the crime was. So we found that kids who had gotten arrested for getting in a fight at school or for truancy or for loitering were being charged, their parents were being charged the same rates as kids who were in jail for homicide.
And South Carolina has a law that punishes students who act in an obnoxious manner. That means pretty much everybody I went to school with, including me.
I would imagine, yes.
So what are some of the consequences students face if they act obnoxiously?
In South Carolina particularly, I know that that law has led to many arrests and they may end up in the juvenile justice system, probably not in secure detention, but probably in some sort of residential facility or probation or something like that.
How does the so-called school-to-prison pipeline fit into this story?
I think it fits in the sense that we're bringing a lot of kids into the juvenile justice system for minor in-school misbehavior, and those kids end up in juvenile justice facilities and their parents end up paying the bills. So just the notion of criminalizing in-school misbehavior is kind of what leads a lot of kids into the system in the first place.
Are any groups disproportionately targeted by this?
you can say targeted or you can use a different word, but African-American children are disproportionately represented in the juvenile justice system, so their families are disproportionately affected by these fines and fees.
And has anything been done by schools to try to reduce racial profiling?
The Obama administration's Department of Education Civil Rights Division did a lot to try to focus on the school-to-prison pipeline and racial disparities and punishment at schools, and they brought investigations into a number of local school districts around the country. So that is work that's being done, but it's still a significant problem.
Haven't disabled children also been affected?
Yes, disabled children are disproportionately involved in the juvenile justice system.
And why? What does a disabled kid do that would warrant being punished?
Things that would warrant treatment and counseling are instead treated as misbehavior, and the police are involved to deal with that misbehavior.
So instead of sending the kid to a shrink, we send the kid to a prison, a reform school?
Well, this happens largely in some of the poorest school districts, where they might not have the resources for counselors and support staff and things like that. So they end up having to deal in a disciplinary manner with problems that could be better dealt with through treatment.
And you mentioned truancy. What makes a student a truant? Can a parent go to jail if their child stops going to school?
I believe that's something that happens in some places, not across the country, though.
My guest is Eli Hager. His article, Your Kid Goes to Jail, You Get the Bill, was done in partnership between the Washington Post and the Marshall Project. Do we know, based on studies, what kinds of discipline actually work to benefit children?
We do know that. I'm not an expert on school discipline, we do know, for example, that corporal punishment and types of physical discipline at schools do not work and lead the children to be more violent themselves or to react negatively to authority. There's definitely research on things like restorative justice in schools and effective ways of dealing with misbehavior that aren't punitive and aren't sending kids into the juvenile justice system.
Well, we've been hearing in recent years about how people who have emotional problems wind up being sent to jail instead of to mental institutions as they might have in the past. And I'm assuming the same sort of thing is happening with emotionally disturbed kids.
Yes, certainly.
What happens if a parent fails to pay on time or fails to pay altogether?
Any number of things can happen. The Juvenile Justice Agency can begin garnishing their wages, and they do this in many states. They garnish 50% of the parents' wages every week. They can intercept their tax returns and take money from that. They can put a lien on their bank accounts and take money from their bank accounts. They can suspend their driver's license, which is another very common practice. So in a number of states, especially Pennsylvania, California, Virginia, we found, did this very aggressively. They take very aggressive action against the parents to get the money that they owe.
And in California, it's a county-by-county
situation. Yes, it's county-by-county in California.
Can parents ever wind up in jail for missing their payments?
We didn't find any cases of that, but they can definitely be charged with contempt of court for ignoring this process or for not paying.
You said that it differs from state to state and county to county. How are the payments calculated?
The payments, so in the places that use the child support system that conceive of this as a form of child support, they charge based on the child support scale. So the parent of a kid in detention is being charged the same monthly amount as an absentee parent who has walked out on the family. So they just use the child support metric. In other states, they just have some percentage of the total cost of the kid's imprisonment they ask the parent to pay every month.
Does it matter whether the place the kid is sent is a public institution or privately operated facility?
It wouldn't seem to matter, but we did find that in the states that rely heavily on privately operated facilities, they're charging parents higher rates.
And do they offer better services because they're charging more?
There's no indication that they do.
What happens if the child is found innocent later, are the parents reimbursed for payments that they've already made?
No, not at all. This is one of the things that I think readers were most interested in our article, is the fact that many kids are ultimately found innocent. They did not do the crime, but the money that the parents have already paid for detention, they still have to pay, and they still owe, and they won't get it back. We found one mother in California who had been billed nearly $10,000 for her son's detention. Her son had been in jail for over a year, and she was billed that much money, and that it turned out he didn't do the crime, but she never got the money back.
And she could have sued?
Presumably, yes.
Are there other costs that parents have to cover if their child is imprisoned?
Well, certainly they're not necessarily billed by the state for other costs, but they have to pay for exorbitant rates for phone calls with their child in jail. They have to drive long distances to the jail, which involves paying for a lot of gas. They have all the same rent and utility bills that they would have had before. It's not as if those go down. They still have to support their other children who are not incarcerated. So all of these costs pile up at this moment that is often the worst moment of a parent's life, seeing their kid in jail.
So when is this determined? When the child is sentenced?
So this is
Does
another,
a judge determine it?
No, it's not a judge that determines it. It's the juvenile justice agency or the child support agency. And a lot of times we found, it again depends on the state, but in a number of states it happens after the fact. So the kid has been in jail for 9 months or 12 months, and then the parent, without any knowledge that this will happen, will get a bill several months later for the whole cost of that incarceration, and then they'll immediately be in debt, and their wages will immediately be garnished to pay back what they owe.
So they're not given a payment plan?
They might be given a payment plan, but they start from a place of debt.
Who is James? Is it Buch?
He is the secretary of the Louisiana's Office of Juvenile Justice.
And what role does he play in this conversation?
Well, he's just the head of the juvenile justice agency in that particular state, Louisiana.
And his arguments are this is a child support issue?
Well, he was one of many juvenile justice administrators who I interviewed, and we did use a quote of his in the article, but his arguments were not uncommon. He said a number of things. He said that making parents pay for the cost of detention is one way of kind of keeping them involved with their kid. If they have their financial skin in the game, they'll stay engaged with their kids. He also argued that a number of these laws have been on the books for many decades, and that he, as a juvenile justice administrator, is just following state law.
And he can't change it.
Right.
Haven't some of the responses to your article argued that the parents should be held responsible for the children's behavior?
Some people have said that, yes. It boils down to a question of whether we think the criminal justice system and public safety should be something that we all pay for as taxpayers, or whether individuals who are involved in those systems should be footing the bill.
And if the parents had been better parents, the argument would go, the kid wouldn't have become a troubled child. Of course, we know from psychology that parents can't always control how a child develops.
Right, that's right. And another argument that gets made is that this would be the parents are somehow intentionally using the juvenile justice system to deal with their delinquent child.
Dumping
the kid, right. And from talking to parents and knowing parents, I think it's pretty rare for a parent to want their kid to go to jail.
My guest is Eli Hager, who's a staff reporter for the Marshall Project, which in partnership with the Washington Post led to his article, Your Kid Goes to Jail, You Get the Bill. We will continue our conversation after this. Eli Hager is here. His article, Your Kid Goes to Jail, You Get the Bill, appeared in the Washington Post and also the Marshall Project, a partnership. Is this a partnership that is a regular thing?
It's a fairly regular thing. We're a nonprofit news organization reporting on the criminal justice system, and we often partner with newspapers and magazines around the country in order to broaden our readership.
Now, there are people who are in the field who disagree with this approach. Can you tell us about Linda O'Neill and Anders Jacobson, the director of the Colorado Division of Youth Corrections? What do they contend?
There's a number of state juvenile justice agencies who do not bill parents for their kids' detention, and they make a number of arguments for why they don't do that. The main one is that this just doesn't bring in that much money. It's not that practical. Compared to the overall costs of running a juvenile justice system, the amount that you can collect from these mostly poor parents is very, very small. So, for example, we've focused in Philadelphia. They brought in just over $500,000, whereas the juvenile justice system costs more than $80 million in the city of Philadelphia. So it's really not practical. Another argument that these more progressive administrators make is that the purpose of a juvenile justice system is to rehabilitate kids and support their families and get them back on the right track, and throwing the whole family into debt at this exact moment is not helpful and will only lead to further delinquency.
What services are parents actually paying for under this policy?
Well, as I said earlier, a lot of times the money just goes into a general fund, a general state fund. But in the cases where it does go actually into the juvenile justice system, you know, it's paying for the detention facilities. But again, only a fraction of what the detention facilities actually cost.
Part of the story involves the conditions that these teenagers in juvenile detention live in. Isn't the California Board of State and Community Corrections soliciting advice from former juveniles?
They're considering advice from former people who were in juvenile detention. There was a survey that was done by a number of advocacy groups in California in the past few months, and they surveyed a number of children or young people who were recently in the juvenile justice system for their advice on how to better run juvenile detention facilities. And the state of California is actually considering that advice as they rewrite their regulations for the detention facilities.
Although California, this isn't policy of the state, is it? Isn't it on a county-to-county basis in California?
Yes, but there are state-level regulations that apply to all of these facilities, even though they're actually run by the counties.
And some states are more punitive than others. At least 20% of about 100 juveniles held at the Broad River Road Juvenile Facility in South Carolina are placed in a crisis management unit. What is that, solitary confinement?
It's a term for solitary confinement, yes.
And how long may they be held under those conditions?
And not for nearly as long as adults are held in those conditions, but there's a movement of advocates who think that children should not be held in solitary confinement at all.
And in South Carolina, is this being debated?
It is being debated. South Carolina is in the middle of a bit of a transition because they recently raised the age so that 17-year-olds will no longer be charged as adults. They will now be considered children.
But they will be at 18. 18 isn't all that different from 17.
True, but it's a large number of people who will now have access to the juvenile justice system instead of the adult and much more punitive adult system. So it's still a significant change. And so now all these young people are headed into the juvenile justice system, which is already having a lot of problems, as you described. So that it's kind of a moment of tension in South Carolina.
Is this kind of policy more likely to exist in counties that suffer from severe budget problems?
Yes. I mean, most of these policies have existed for decades, so it's hard to say that it's a response to a current budget problem, but that is a justification that officials use. They say that we have budget problems, we need all the money we can get, so we're going to collect this money from parents.
So it's more likely to exist in areas where there's already a lot of poverty, where the parents are least likely to be able to pay.
Well, the children who get involved in the juvenile justice system often come from poverty, so their parents, by definition, are also poor and don't have a lot of ability to pay these costs.
Tell us about Stephen Kaplan. What's his role in this?
So he is a private attorney in the city of Philadelphia, and ever since 1998, the city of Philadelphia has paid him up to $316,000 a year, which is more than any city employee, including the mayor, to personally collect the money from these parents whose kids are in jail. And so he meets with the parents one-on-one multiple times a week, gets out his calculator, tells them this is how much you owe for your kid's incarceration, and then he collects it from them through wage garnishment and all these other measures. But
then he gets a percentage of that to pay for him. There would almost be an incentive for him to be as tough as possible.
He gets bonuses based on the amount he collects from the parents, yes. And in some cases, as I said earlier, he's only billing parents $5 a month or something. So these are very, very poor parents. But in other cases, it's up to $1,000 a month. There's news on that front, which is that Steve Kaplan's contract is ending on March 31st, and the city of Philadelphia announced that it will no longer be using his services, so this will be over as of March 31st.
Is that because there's been pressure on the city to change the policy?
Yes, that's because of the work of an advocacy group called the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, and also law students at Temple University, at the Justice Lab at Temple University. They got together. They became aware of this practice. They brought it to the mayor's office. They've been applying pressure to the city's Department of Human Services for many months now. And then that pressure in combination with the recent news coverage, including our article, led to this decision by Philadelphia to stop doing this.
Who's Jessica Fireman? What is her role in this?
She works for something called the Juvenile Law Center, which is a legal advocacy group, which is it's a national group, but it's based in Philadelphia. And she's researched multiple types of fines and fees that families in the juvenile justice system face around the country.
But Philadelphia still will continue to bill parents for some costs.
Right.
Foster care, for example.
Foster care.
Dependency placements.
Exactly. They will continue to bill parents for the cost of foster care and other dependency placements, but no longer for incarceration. That's what they'll be stopping.
Hasn't the number of children in juvenile facilities been on the decline?
Yes, it has, very dramatically. In fact, I think that's gone somewhat unnoticed, even as the quote-unquote mass incarceration of adults has continued up until the past few years. The number of kids in the juvenile justice system has actually plummeted since 2000.
Why do you think this hasn't gotten more attention?
The decline in youth incarceration?
Well, on the one hand, because it became an issue during the presidential campaign, the decline in people being arrested in general, but also the crime rate has gone down. But also, in this case, these kids, is it simply because they're kind of an invisible population?
Well, I think that one of the reasons why the issue of parents being charged for their children's incarceration has gone unnoticed is because there's nobody really looking out for parents specifically. So what I mean by that is that there are public defenders and other lawyers who represent kids who have been accused of crimes, and they represent them in court. But the parents are not actually accused of a crime, and they don't have a right to a lawyer or anything like that. So there's nobody actually looking out for their separate interests, such as having to pay these bills. So I think it was kind of a gap in advocacy that allowed this to go unnoticed for so long.
So what's your sense? Is this going to be phased out throughout much of the country?
No, that's not my sense at all. I mean, Philadelphia did take this step because there was so much advocacy and because of the news coverage. And in California, there's a real effort at the county level. There's a group of advocates led by something called the Reentry Solutions Group in the Contra Costa County area who are going county by county in California to try to get the fees banned, and they've already succeeded in three counties. And there's also a bill there that was introduced in January to ban the fees statewide. But other than Philadelphia and California, there's really not much evidence to me that this practice will be changing anywhere.
Now, when it's on a county level, we are not talking about lawmakers instituting these policies, are we? Is that usually the case on a state level? It would mean that the state legislature would have to pass laws that call for this sort of thing, and then the governor would have to sign the bill?
Well, you can stop a practice by law or by practice. So you could, in most of these states, even if counties are doing this practice, they're using an existing statute to say, we can charge you under this statute. So you could either, as a state, you could have legislators agree, we're going to repeal that statute or write a different statute and say that counties can't do this anymore, or individual county juvenile justice administrators could just decide by practice, we're not going to bill parents anymore because it's not bringing in that much money.
Are you working on a new investigation?
Yes, I am, but I cannot,
you don't want to reveal.
I can't tell you.
Is it related to this?
It's unrelated. But I mean, it's still criminal justice system, but it's not related directly.
The article, "Your Kid Goes to Jail, You Get the Bill," was done in partnership between the Marshall Project and the Washington Post. And you can access it. You can find it, a link to it, on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Eli Hager, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks again for having me.